The 1939 novel won John Steinbeck a Pulitzer Prize, and the 1940 film version won 2 Academy Awards. Now, The Grapes of Wrath has become a play, opening this weekend in Chicago. This first stage adaptation was molded by Chicago's Steppenwolf Company. It follows the Joad family from the 1930s Oklahoma Dust Bowl to the migrant camps of California. Marge Halperin reports the play remains true to the book in plot, character portrayal, and emotional power.
After a lifelong fascination with Steinbeck, Steppenwolf director Frank Galati finally persuaded the author's estate to let him adapt Grapes of Wrath. Steinbeck's wife Elaine had turned down similar requests, but was impressed with Steppenwolf's work, so she agreed to let Galati turn the 600-page novel into a play. He did it by following Steinbeck's own directions.
Steinbeck, in his journal, which he kept during the composition of the novel, was always reminding himself not to rush, not to hurry, to focus on details, not to be impatient. He knew the story before he started telling it. So he persisted in reminding himself of how important it was to focus on details and not to rush.
Frank Galati didn't have Steinbeck's freedom to linger over every detail, but the form of the play is the form of the novel. They share the same crisis point and climax, and the action of the play follows the action of the novel. That's not to say that Galati tossed the rest. He salvaged as many of Steinbeck's words and images as possible, using several techniques to telescope the story.
Go over the line, pick cotton and fall. Why don't you go on west, west to California? There's a work there, and it never gets cold. You can reach out anywhere, pick you an orange. Why don't you go on west, west to California?
Some of those chapters are chapters that actually do sing. I mean, you get the sense that Steinbeck is introducing voice by voice by voice by voice a whole chorus of American voices, and that those voices aspire, sometimes in the course of the book, they aspire to song. So we've just given them song.
Galati says the songs sprinkled throughout this play are sung with Steinbeck's own words, capturing the flavor of the novel. Galati has also borrowed Steinbeck's technique of interspersing narration to paint a scene, drawing on it also to fold together different parts of the story.
Tom saw a line of men standing in the ditch beside the road, saw their mouths open, as though they were yelling, saw their shaking fists, their furious faces.
The grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage.
The narrators for the play are characters Galati has called brother and sister. They embellish the universal feel Steinbeck has created, guiding the audience along the Joad family's journey, stringing together scenes of the Joad struggle to survive.
Hamburg, like to have some Hamburg? 20 cents a pound, Hamburg.
Ain't that awful high?
Well,
seems to me Hamburg was 15 cents last time I got some.
Well, yes, it's high. Same time it ain't high. Time you go in town for a couple pounds of Hamburg, it'll cost you about a gallon of gas. So you see it ain't really high here because you got no gallon of gas.
Didn't cost you no gallon of gas to get it here.
Well, now you're looking at it all bass-ackwards. See, we ain't a-buying it. We're a-selling it. If we was a-buying it, why, that'd be different.
Putting this story on stage is more than a logistical process of cutting scenes and threading the narrative. This cast also wants to capture the emotional intensity Steinbeck has created. The actors have read and reread the novel, seen the movie several times. They probably know more about these characters than about virtually any other they might have portrayed, and far more than they can hope to show their audience in this slimmed-down version of the story. Yvonne Suhr, who plays the role of the pregnant Rose of Sharon, describes her character in the 1940 movie as an ingenue who got short shrift on the big screen. Suhr is determined that won't be Rose of Sharon's fate on stage.
You're bringing, tons and tons of stuff to maybe one line.
Yeah.
Something that was a chapter in the book is now in one line, and you sort of feel a personal responsibility. It's exhausting because, you know, you've got that chapter in your mind, and that chapter took you an hour to read because you kept going back and going, oh my gosh, oh no.
Suhr isn't the only one in this 41-member cast taking her role so seriously. Cheryl Bruce, who plays the part of the narrator's sister, found that rehearsals became something of a group therapy session.
It goes deeper than just remembering my lines.
We have discussions amongst ourselves about what we saw or what we're now understanding that a person has brought to life on stage, and it sets off like a ping pong ball in a room full of mouse traps. It just sets all these connections together, and then you get charged and you want to do it again. I don't feel like, oh, I don't want to do a scene again.
I'm just discovering it, you know. I mean, every day you discover it.
Yeah.
Things just start making more sense, and then they get more complicated. Yeah. That's
Gary
right.
Sinise, who plays Tom Joad, is struck by the way the novel cuts so deeply into human emotion. He and the rest of the cast hope to charge their audiences with the same power that fuels their characters.
Grandma's awful sick.
When you're young, Rosie Sharon, everything that happens is a thing all by itself. There's a time of change, and when that time comes, dying is a piece of all dying, and barren is a piece of all barren, and barren and dying is two pieces of the same thing. And then things ain't lonely anymore. And then a hurt don't hurt so bad, because it ain't a lonely hurt no more, Rosa Sharon. I wished I could tell you so you'd know, but
I bet the audience is going to be just sitting there like hammered sheep. Like, yeah. What is that? I have seen shows where the ending is so cataclysmic that the audience can't move for a minute. I know, I feel in my heart that people are going to have to just catch their breath. Because we do in rehearsal sometimes.
Yeah, we do. If we do our job, yeah, it'll be like you read the novel, you know. You read the novel and you put it down and you're just stunned.
You don't have anything to say. You
just can't talk. Yes. I want to drop them to their knees. I want them to crawl out of there.
It's a goal Steinbeck surely would have appreciated. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Clarksville, Ozark. Van Buren and Fort Smith on 64. There's an end to Arkansas. And all the roads into Oklahoma City. 66 down from Tulsa. 270 up from McAllister. 81 from Wichita Falls.
This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards.
If the top would only stay on the soil. If only the dust wouldn't fly.
If the top would only stay on the soil, if only the dust wouldn't fly. Those are Steinbeck's own words, a vivid image that sang on his page, now given an audible tune. All of the lyrics used in this play come from the novel, a technique that shows how faithfully The Grapes of Wrath has been adapted for the stage. Often an adaptation turns out to be a new twist on an old story. But with Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck's picture is so complete, his words so compelling, that creating a stage play was a matter of condensing the 600-page novel, not rewriting parts, adding new bridges, or updating scenes. For the theater, director Frank Galati crammed in as many of Steinbeck's images as possible. He uses the music to match what he says is the pacing of the novel.
You know, in some ways, the novel is kind of like a ballad with alternating stanzas, and it has a kind of breathing rhythm. And that has a gathering effect on the reader. The fact that you come to the end of a specific chapter about the Joads, and then you have a landscape, and it may be just two or three pages, but it gives you an opportunity to sort of reflect upon and deepen the experience that you've had in the specific chapter while you're looking over the whole course of the issues.
The musical interludes mix with narration, which Galati has assigned to characters he generically calls sister and brother.
Tom saw a line of men standing in the ditch beside the road, saw their mouths open, as though they were yelling, saw their shaking fists, their furious faces.
The grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage.
These interludes of song and narration give the audience much-needed breathing room. Without them, Grapes of Wrath might be too intense for the stage. They also serve to condense the story. We don't hear all 600 pages of the novel, and Frank Galati says we don't have to.
We have, obviously, a problem in terms of the duration of the telling of the story and the duration of the actual story. They're not the same duration. So we've always got to be folding time and stretching time and playing with time and with landscape in order to get it all in. But that gives the telling of the story a real interesting variety, an interesting rhythm of its own.
It's not easy to witness up close the constant trials of the Joad family as they're driven off their land to serve as migrant farmers in California. This is a story of ironies and opposites. We follow the family through the depths of the Great Depression as they move alongside those more fortunate.
Hamburg, like to have some Hamburg? 20 cents a pound, Hamburg.
Ain't that awful high?
Well,
seems to me Hamburg was 15 cents last time I got some.
Well, yes, it's high. Same time it ain't high. Time you go in town for a couple pounds of Hamburg, it'll cost you about a gallon of gas. So you see, it ain't really high here because you got no gallon of gas.
Didn't cost you no gallon of gas to get it here.
Well, now you're looking at it all bass-ackwards. See, we ain't a-buying it. We're a-selling it. If we was a-buying it, why, that'd be different.
It looks awful of fat and gristle.
Well, I ain't a-guaranteeing she won't cook down. I ain't guaranteeing I'd eat her myself. Bet there's lots of stuff I wouldn't do.
Of course, this is more than a story of greed and misfortune. In his analysis of human nature, Steinbeck has also captured the Joad's strength and that of the relationships they form. Yvonne Suhr, who plays the pregnant Rose of Sharon, says that in this adaptation, as in the novel, each character retells the story of hope in adversity.
All of us get to go through a journey in like, there are a lot of roles that could be just small roles, and, you know, all so-and-so's in the play, Noah, so we have to stick them in there and give them a funny line. But everyone gets to go through something and gets to expose their worst fear and gets to come out of it a little better person, and every main character has a journey. It's a journey of the human spirit.
We want to live in a town. Connie's going to get a job in a store, maybe a factory, and he's going to study at night so he can get to be an expert maybe later, or have his own store, and we'll go to the pictures whenever. And Connie says, I'm going to have a doctor when the baby's born, and he says, we'll see how times is, and it'll be nice. Little car. And after he studies at night, well, it'll be nice. And he tore a page out of Western love stories, and he's going to send off for a course because it don't cost nothing to send off. It says right on that clip, and I seen it. And why? They even get you a job when you take that course. Radios it is, nice, clean work and a future, and we'll live in town and go to the pictures.
I think we're all a little bit stunned.
Director Frank Galati.
By the mystery and the size of the story. I mean, it's life-changing in a way. I mean, it's a privilege to have the experience. We've learned so much about ourselves, as well as about the novel, about what it is to be human, what it is to love, what it is truly to sacrifice oneself, what it is to be in need and to give.
No doubt it was that commitment to the material that won Galati the permission to adapt the story. When Grapes of Wrath was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1940, it was heralded as an important social commentary on the class structure etched out by the Depression. Its revival by the Steppenwolf Theater Company updates that commentary, reflecting today's homeless and downtrodden as clearly as if it were rewritten in a 1988 setting. That's the power of the story and of this adaptation. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. The host intro. A basketball, or maybe two or three, are suspended in an aquarium full of fluid. A pristine Hoover vacuum cleaner is hanging on the wall, backed by glowing fluorescent tubes. On another wall, a Nike poster of Dr. Dunkenstein is blown up bigger than life. These are the elements of 33-year-old New York artist Jeff Koons' current exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. His unusual work, stemming from ready-made objects, is creating a stir in the art world. And here's where you need your reference to the Whitney exhibit. As Marge Halpern reports, viewers are debating whether these unusual materials are effective carriers of Koons' artistic message. Throughout the centuries, those who view new art styles tend to ask variations on a single question. The modern version might be, you call that art? And it's a question many have asked of Jeff Koons and fellow appropriationists, those who draw their materials from ready-made, everyday sources. Koons demands that we rethink our definition of art as we look at his floating basketballs, an inflatable plastic rabbit and palm tree sitting on stainless steel and mirrored plates, or his stainless renditions of everyday kitsch, from a bust of Louis XIV to a dime store figurine. Museum of Contemporary Art director Michael Danoff says to appreciate these pieces, viewers should forget everything they know about the original objects.
I think that what happens is that they walk into the show and they see a basketball, which they think of obviously in a sport context, and something that looks like an aquarium or some sort of tank that one might find in a scientific laboratory, and all of a sudden it sort of feels emotional to them. It's wrenched out of its normal context. It starts to feel emotional. It's about life in a way, just floating or containment or enclosure. I think that people respond like that.
Jeff Koons says these familiar objects are merely a starting point, common ground on which he can meet his audience before taking it to new heights. Koons says he doesn't want to get bogged down in constructing his own materials. He's pleased, for example, to have made his stainless steel bust of Louis XIV into an effective commentary on social decadence just by casting an existing marble bust.
To present that as a finished piece is much better for myself, because if I personally would be involved in modeling the bust, I would end up getting lost and involved in issues that are so subjective and are not really important to a public for a social dialogue that I would become a contaminating element in my own work. I'm staying more involved on an intellectual level with the object without becoming involved with it on a physical, personal level.
Koons' pieces are grouped around certain themes. The vacuum cleaner pieces, for instance, are part of his series titled The New. They address ideas of the value we place on pristine quality, as well as his thoughts about life sustenance, the vacuums relying on air to function just as people do. The inflatable bunny is another air breath-oriented piece. But Chicago Tribune art critic Ellen Artner says Koons and many other appropriationists fail to communicate their deep concerns with much of their audience. The reason, Artner says, is that these are 1980s might be expected to do. Take Koons' explanation of his 1986 rabbit, a highly detailed stainless steel rendition of the inflatable rabbit clutching a carrot.
I really wanted that to almost have the effect of when you're driving through the country, you'll see in someone's yard one of these crystal balls in a bird bath, a round reflective ball. And I wanted the rabbit to also be able to exploit a certain sexual aspect of it, a sinister aspect of it, a political aspect. The rabbit's very much like an orator. The carrot in the hand, to me, is very much like a microphone making some type of proclamation. It's also very much like a masturbative image, having the carrot in the hand.
By drawing on existing objects, then launching into dissertations about the meaning of their work, critic Artner feels appropriationists are only underscoring a deficit in the work and in our times.
David Sally, Julian Schnabel, Jeff Koons, a number of other people whose names have become rather prominent within the last 10 years, are pretty much reflecting empty times. It's always a little bit of a mistake to say that artists who have nothing going from them can be made into stars or superstars simply by a kind of promotion blitz. They have to touch some nerve in the time. And that's what I say. Koons has done that. The appropriation artists have done that. I just don't see that what they're saying about our times is particularly significant or worth explicating to the degree that he has.
Certainly, art lovers have never been compelled to fully understand a work in order to appreciate it. For Koons, however, the philosophical impact is as important as is the visual impact of his work. He's as much concerned with the message as with the medium.
One of the main issues that I'm involved with is communication. So I would like my work to communicate to as clearly and as precisely to the audience as possible. But there's also the responsibility that the artist has is to be as specific as possible and in this communication to give as much information as they can.
But is the audience picking up on Kuhn's clues? Influential London collector Charles Saatchi has. His investments in Kuhn's work has made this young artist very popular, helping bring his work to a large sector of the art world. But whether Kuhn's can reach the masses he seems to be after remains to be seen. Kuhn's is working on a new series of ceramic pieces, including several replicas of stuffed toys. That show will tour Cologne, Pittsburgh, New York, and Chicago this fall, giving new viewers the chance to make up their mind about Kuhn's communication skills. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
In an oral culture, there are certain ideas that are going to fade away quickly if somebody doesn't find some way to preserve them. And today, and in the future, one of the most powerful preservations of the old ways is in these images. And there are hundreds of them.
Tradition is fading fast in the Canadian Arctic, where the Inuit people are trading igloos for government housing and doing much of their hunting in grocery stores. A small group of artists working in a cooperative in the community of Baker Lake are hoping to preserve the spiritual facet of their Eskimo tradition, capturing on paper the legends of their ancestors. Highlights of their work have been put together into a traveling show titled Shamans and Spirits, Myths and Medical Symbolism. It's a show that mixes modern techniques with ancient culture. These are children imitating the sounds of their father's tools as they play in the village of Baker Lake. They probably have never met a shaman. The old medicine people of the Inuit tribe have all but vanished today thanks to the preachings of Catholic and Anglican missionaries. But through the work of local artists, the children will learn of the shaman's many roles: village doctor, psychiatrist, philosopher, and spiritual leader. Working through the Sanovic Cooperative, these artists are retelling stories they heard from their parents and grandparents, stories about the spirits who shaped the world for their ancestors, giving them hope and direction in an otherwise harsh environment. Artist William Noah's contribution to the Shamans and Spirits exhibition is Kizzyuk's Journey, a drawing of Inuit hero Kizzyuk riding a giant fish across the sea to search for his wife and children. It's a tale Noah heard often from his mother and grandmother, one he was anxious to pass on, as he explains to us via a satellite phone system.
If we don't draw these pictures, our tradition of life and the stories, I'm sure will be forgotten for good. The only way we can tell it now is on a piece of paper.
William Noah's work and that of others in this exhibition show how closely man and animal lived as both fought to survive in the brutal Arctic. Typically, these prints, made from stencils, stone cuts, engravings, and lithographs, present animals as friends of the Inuit people, necessary for survival, both as guides to nature and, of course, as food. But when seen through Eskimo eyes, even hunting is a gentle, cooperative pursuit, according to exhibition coordinator Linda Crawford.
There's a lot of poetry and song that indicates that intimacy. In fact, there's one about the caribou that's a great favorite of mine. It's called Magic Words to Bring Luck When Hunting Caribou. And the song, and I'm going to say it, not sing it, of course, translated is great swan, great caribou bull, the land that lies before me here, let it alone yield abundant meat, be rich in vegetation, your moss food. Come here, come here. Your bones you must move out and in. To me you must give yourself.
Another Inuit tribute to the caribou was recorded at Baker Lake. When these stories are made into prints, the Inuit artists don't give them formal titles. Works in this show have transcribed titles based on conversations with the artists. These are vividly descriptive phrases written right on the prints. The world of man and the world of animals come together in the shaman is a drawing of a shaman with outstretched wing-like arms filled with animal and human figures. A frightened spirit stares wide-eyed, caught between two fierce-looking wolves, painted a vivid green. Nearly all of these works use bright colors, either primary or pastels, with virtually no blending. Heavy black outlines give the pieces a primitive, two-dimensional look, but the complex images and the detailed stories are anything but primitive. Linda Crawford explains the work, A Dying Man Becomes a Wolf, an image that can't be read in a simplistic Western style of left to right. This story is spread all over the page.
What's happening is that the man is dying, and his daughter, who is singing a song or saying something, declaring it, and what she's saying or singing is above her head in the syllabics. You see those strange marks above her head, almost like a cartoon bubble would be, you know? I'm not willing to make a literal interpretation because that sort of belies the whole point here. The point is to keep it in flux. But let's say she's singing it into existence, that he is transforming into the creature that he was most intimately connected with in his life.
Though it's impossible for outsiders to judge how prevalent these spiritual beliefs might be in today's Inuit villages, it's premature to say that the Inuit people have been modernized. Artist William Noah gave a typically cryptic answer to questions about shamans today, saying that if there are any, they don't practice publicly, out of respect for and fear of the area's new churches. It's the job of Noah and fellow artists to make sure, however, that the shamans and spirits live on in memory. And while they chronicle the stories for their own people, Linda Crawford is hoping the traveling exhibition of their work will teach the rest of us a few things.
A lot of this sounds very exotic, and yet the whole ability to be able to see more than is apparent is at the heart of wisdom in our culture as well. To have the third eye and to be able to pierce through appearances in life down to what is what we call a wise person. The shaman is one who has the ability to see and is sometimes called the seer.
The Shamans and Spirits exhibition will be at Chicago's Field Museum through September 5th, then travels to the State University of New York in Oswego and the Lauren Rogers Museum of Art in Laurel, Mississippi. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. No-nonsense business practices are meshing with the most advanced educational theories as the doors swing open in Chicago today for the nation's first corporate community school. An experiment launched by a coalition of corporate leaders, this tuition-free private school is designed as a model for urban education across the country. Set up in Chicago's poor Lawndale neighborhood on the city's west side, this is the first of what founders hope will be many such models to spring up in all major cities. Marge Halperin explains how the school works. Founded by some of Chicago's most successful business leaders, the differences in this school begin with its administration. While most public schools are run by low-level managers, directed by an unwieldy bureaucracy, the corporate community school's policy comes from an 11-member board of directors. The principal is designated the chief executive officer. As CEO, it's up to Dr. Elaine Mosley to boost her students' skills and to prevent them from adding to Chicago's already high dropout rate. If she fails, Mosley, like any other CEO, loses her job.
I say that's fair play, because if I'm not living up to the expectations of my board of directors, I should elect to move on, and if I don't, then I should be moved on. That's unlike what happens in so many of our schools, where you do have obviously a lot of dynamic people doing outstanding jobs, but you also have the other element.
The corporate and community leaders who make up Mosley's board of directors have picked a strong CEO, and they're giving her a good learning environment. Corporate donations make up $1 million annual budget. Limiting enrollment to 2 through 8-year-olds, there's enough money to keep class size down to a maximum of 24 students. And this former Catholic school building underwent a $780,000 rehab, including carpeted classrooms and Euro-style cabinets in the cafeteria, as well as special academic centers.
And here, we have our computer lab. Mm-hmm. You'll notice that it is air-conditioned, and the reason why is we plan to have quite a few computers in this room, per se, and this is where the children will be able to come and use the computers. We hope to actually have them do some word processing. For the smaller children, we want to orientate them to the computer, as well as let them do some problem solving with the computers also. So we plan to have the computer lab very well utilized.
primary teacher Lois Heyman is pleased with the school's amenities, but she and the rest of the staff are most excited about the educational program. The school's flexible, student-oriented philosophy was hammered out during some 150 hours of meetings between Dr. Mosley and her staff. It calls for a year-round program so that, as Mosley puts it, the students' brains won't go on summer vacation. Classes start for two-year-olds, in keeping with current thinking that early childhood education strengthens the rest of the school years. Teachers here speak in terms of ages because students won't be assigned a particular grade level. By allowing them to progress at their own rate, says 7- and 8-year-old teacher Harlene Sterenberg, the students are programmed for success and will never experience the setback of having to repeat a grade.
Some children learn better from listening. Some children learn better from seeing something. Some people need to see something over and over and over, and other children need to work with it with their hands. And I like to look at it more like a doctor looks at his patients. Every patient has something different. This child needs more work on comprehension. This one needs more work on phonics. He is not able to sound out words. This child is just really needing help with his math facts. And we're going to say, wonder why he doesn't know his math facts. Let's find out.
Even Chicago public school officials agree that the model school's emphasis on critical thinking, self-esteem, and parental involvement will help these students reach their full potential. But founders don't want to limit their impact, even though there's room this first year for only 150 of the more than 1,000 students who applied in the enrollment lottery process. It's business executive Joe Kelman who first conceived of the corporate community school, and he has more lofty goals.
This is not just another school.
No-nonsense business practices are meshing with the most advanced educational theories as the doors swing open in Chicago today for the nation's first corporate community school. An experiment launched by a coalition of corporate leaders, this tuition-free private school is designed as a model for urban education across the country. Set up in Chicago's poor Lawndale neighborhood on the city's west side, this is the first of what founders hope will be many such models to spring up in all major cities. Marge Halperin explains how the school works. Founded by some of Chicago's most successful business leaders, the differences in this school begin with its administration. While most public schools are run by low-level managers, directed by an unwieldy bureaucracy, the corporate community school's policy comes from an 11-member board of directors. The principal is designated the chief executive officer. As CEO, it's up to Dr. Elaine Mosley to boost her students' skills and to prevent them from adding to Chicago's already high dropout rate. If she fails, Mosley, like any other CEO, loses her job.
I say that that's fair play because if I'm not living up to the expectations of my board of directors, I should elect to move on. And if I don't, then I should be moved on. That's unlike what happens in so many of our schools where you do have obviously a lot of dynamic people doing outstanding jobs, but you also have the other element.
The corporate and community leaders who make up Mosley's board of directors have picked a strong CEO, and they're giving her a good learning environment. Corporate donations make up $1 million annual budget. Limiting enrollment to 2- through 8-year-olds, there's enough money to keep class size down to a maximum of 24 students. And this former Catholic school building underwent a $780,000 rehab, including carpeted classrooms and Euro-style cabinets in the cafeteria, as well as special academic centers.
And here we have our computer lab.
You notice that it is air conditioned, and the reason why is we plan to have quite a few computers in this room per se, and this is where the children will be able to come and use the computers. We hope to actually have them do some word processing. For the smaller children, we want to orientate them to the computer as well as let them do some problem solving with the computers also. So we plan to have the computer lab very well utilized.
Primary teacher Lois Heyman is pleased with the school's amenities, but she and the rest of the staff are most excited about the educational program. The school's flexible, student-oriented philosophy was hammered out during some 150 hours of meetings between Dr. Mosley and her staff. It calls for a year-round program so that, as Mosley puts it, the students' brains won't go on summer vacation. Classes start for two-year-olds, in keeping with current thinking that early childhood education strengthens the rest of the school years. Teachers here speak in terms of ages, because students won't be assigned a particular grade level. By allowing them to progress at their own rate, says 7 and 8-year-old teacher Harleen Sterenberg, the students are programmed for success and will never experience the setback of having to repeat a grade.
Some children learn better from listening. Some children learn better from seeing something. Some people need to see something over and over and over, and other children need to work with it with their hands. And I like to look at it more like a doctor looks at his patients. Every patient has something different. This child needs more work on comprehension. This one needs more work on phonics. He is not able to sound out words. This child is just really needing help with his math facts. And we're going to say, wonder why he doesn't know his math facts. Let's find out.
Even Chicago public school officials agree that the model school's emphasis on critical thinking, self-esteem, and parental involvement will help these students reach their full potential. But founders don't want to limit their impact, even though there's room this first year for only 150 of the more than 1,000 students who applied in the enrollment lottery process. It's business executive Joe Kelman who first conceived of the corporate community school, and he has more lofty goals.
This is not just another school. This school is designed to impact the system so that we won't be doing what many community agencies do, saving a handful while a system turns them out by the hundreds of thousands. This model school can be considered their research and development laboratory.
As head of this R&D lab, Principal Elaine Mosley knows the Chicago Public Schools, with their crumbling buildings, low teacher salaries, and disenfranchised parents, are a far cry from her more ideal setting. But she still thinks her program has plenty to offer the public schools.
No, this one school can't do it all. But what we can do is we can provide an impetus, we can plant seeds. Those seeds can grow. Many of the components of this school are replicable. Because when you're talking about philosophy, when you're talking about management, when you're talking about organization, those are not things that you're putting a price tag on.
If it is to improve Chicago's public schools, the timing of this model school couldn't be better. Spurred by U.S. Education Secretary William Bennett's pronouncement that these are the nation's worst public schools, the Illinois legislature this summer approved a sweeping reform bill. It pulls some of the power from the city's central school board to put each local school under the direction of its own board of directors, made up of community leaders, teachers, and parents. When these new businesses set up shop next year, they'll surely want to confer with the CEO of the corporate community school. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. Nothing lasts forever, and that can include fine works of art. But a small group of trained conservators working around the country do know how to prolong the life of masterpiece paintings, combining a bit of history, chemistry, and artistic ability. Marge Halperin reports on the work done at the Chicago Conservation Center, billed as the largest independent such center in the country. The huge loft-style room is littered with paintings. Across one table lies a contemporary work that fell off a wall and landed on a pile of flower pots. Another table is covered with older paintings. Each has a swatch of bright, clean color where a test spot of yellowed varnish was removed. Propped on an easel is a painting that had warped and wrinkled in the corners with age, now stretched smooth across a new frame. These are the works of Barry Bauman and his staff at the Chicago Conservation Center. The first step is always to take photos, the before pictures, that the owner of the painting can keep to help judge the conservation. Then Bauman will clean the work, moving it slowly under a microscope and dabbing at darkened, discolored varnish with a Q-tip soaked in the appropriate solvent.
And you can see that areas in a painting that are intended to be white, and I mean white clouds and white sheep and white lace, are exactly supposed to be that color usually.
Like behind him here, this probably is a brighter blue?
That's right. This is supposed to be blue water, but when I put underneath the varnish, you can't see it. It looks green. When I do remove the varnish in that area, you can see the nice blue tone come through.
Removing old varnish does more than brighten colors. Bauman says it restores the original dimensions of the painting, its sense of space. The darker the varnish, the flatter the work becomes, often obscuring the true talent of the artist. Once the surface is cleaned, the structure of the painting will be repaired. That might mean restretching a canvas or fixing a tear, as was done on an 18th-century French painting titled Lita and the Swan. It came into the center with a 3-foot rip invisible on the restored work, but glaringly clear when Bauman rolls up a cart topped with a large ultraviolet light.
So with the painting now under ultraviolet light, it's actually very easy to see where the tear occurred. And you can see it runs totally from the left-hand side to the right-hand side of the painting and through the forehead of Lita. When the painting came in, this whole flap of torn canvas was just falling out. You can also see other very tiny dots of black or purple, which are areas that we've done very minor retouching work on. With these older paintings, you can get all sorts of abrasions into the paint surface and fly specks that leave a little acidic stain on the painting, and we try to correct those in the final stages or retouching areas of the work.
Filling in those specks is a job that usually falls to Cornelia Iklosan, former conservator for the National Museum in Bucharest, now on staff at the Chicago Conservation Center. We found her seated in front of a 17th century Spanish painting of St. Jerome in the Wilderness.
I retouch here and knit here because it's a little white, this red. I need to retouch here and I retouch.
You make the red brighter in
and,
here?
Yes, need the bright red here, and also many, many crackles.
How do you fix it where it's crackled?
The cracks are just part of older paintings. Oftentimes, though, some of the cracks are so disfiguring through a face, let's say, or through the hand, that we will carefully correct the difference that has been caused by the dark crack.
Someone used to just looking at artwork may wonder about the ethics of working on someone else's canvas. Barry Bauman touts his credentials, including a background in art history, chemistry, and drawing and painting, before making it clear that as a conservator, he has no interest in changing a work, just in restoring it.
The conservator never paints on the original painting. We always put down a buffer layer first of synthetic varnish that is easily reversible, and all our painting goes on top of this layer of varnish so that we're not locked in the future to what we did today. Somebody in the future might know more than what we know today, and we'd like to give them the opportunity to be able to undo what we've done.
More serious a problem, Bauman contends, is the prospect of having no one to work on damaged paintings so that they'd never again be viewed as the artist intended. He won't get any argument from the Chicago Historical Society's director, Ellsworth Brown, who sent over paintings damaged in a basement flood 2 years ago.
You have to be there, have to have been there, when people, even as the water was being pumped out, some of them had hip boots, some of them couldn't find anymore in town, waded into this waist-deep water and started to hand these person to person with flashlights because the power was out, over a chain of probably 15 or 20 people to bring them to the outside. If you looked at those, you would wonder whether any one of them could have been saved. And yet canvas and oil paints particularly, I guess, are very tough.
The Chicago Conservation Center is still working on the Historical Society collection, but has written off as unsalvageable only a dozen of the 174 damaged paintings. Like many major museums, the Historical Society has its own conservators, but the staff isn't big enough to handle this large-scale task. This and other small institutions make up the bulk of the Conservation Center's clientele, along with such corporate collectors as the First National Bank of Chicago and the Sara Lee Corporation. But Ellsworth Brown says the center's greatest contribution might be to its smaller clients, private collectors.
Other people have floods and fires and accidents and things get punched through paintings and fabric gets ripped and has to be fixed. Anybody who has a painting who wants it fixed can walk in the door and say, may I hire your services? And that puts that kind of specialized service, which tends to be historically used to be a museum-based kind of service, in front of the public.
And Brown has his own reasons for wanting individuals to take advantage of this service. He knows that today's collectors may be tomorrow's museum donors, and those who regularly visit a conservator will make his job easier. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. Fine art, craft, decorative art, and studio craft are the art world's equivalent of the class labels used to segregate people. Determined not to be second-class citizens, craft artists working in glass, clay, and wood are clamoring to be recognized as equals with classical sculptors and painters. They're getting a big boost from an exhibition now traveling the country. Titled The Eloquent Object, this show strives to knock down the barriers between craft and art, challenging those who claim the two are unequal in their ability to touch touch a viewer. Marge Halpern reports from Chicago, where the show is now on display at the Public Library's Cultural Center.
There's times when I thought the grill on a 52 Buick was art.
There aren't any automobile parts in this show. Most of the pieces are far more mainstream than glass sculptor Craig Kallenberger suggests. But he does point out the key message of the exhibition: art is in the eye of the beholder.
There's a lot of stuff out there that's classified as art that I don't consider art. But I might find a bowl, or I may have something that I use every day in my life that I think is so beautifully designed and so perfect that to me it's art. And I think that should be left up to the viewer.
The eloquent object was organized by University of Tulsa art chairman Tom Manhart and his wife Marcia, executive director of Tulsa's Philbrook Museum. Their goal was to offer a universal definition of art, one that includes objects traditionally thought of as studio crafts, those made of clay, glass, or wood. This craft show isn't the type featured in Family Circle or Women's Day. It's not the display of dried flower magnets or crocheted tissue boxes you'll find at the mall. It's about the merging of craft and art.
This really has nothing to do with our grandmothers sitting by the fire and crocheting necessarily, even though a lot of those traditions and techniques have evolved, but they have far transcended the way that perhaps our grandmother had pieced a quilt or had crocheted a doily. Today, a quilt maker, for instance, will have conceived the work, the color in the work, the composition, and so forth, to create a very pleasing pattern and decoration, a painting, if you will, that is out of cloth. And that really is the difference.
The roots of studio craft may be found in handicrafts, but Marcia Manhart wants the comparison to end there. These pieces, she says, are art. There's Wendell Castle's table with gloves and keys, ordinary objects casually strewn across a hall table, but all carved from a single piece of mahogany. And Wayne Higby's Raku bowl, titled Apparition Canyon. This bowl, too beautiful to fill with fruit, is painted with a scene that seems to glide and shift the way a real landscape does as you approach it. Tom Manhart says these are pieces that stir a viewer the way art is supposed to do.
I think that they're full of energy, and that is something that sometimes I find hard to locate in a lot of the arts nowadays. That art is becoming very slick and very polished and very professional and all those kinds of things. And somehow that internal energy and magic is lost in the process.
Marcia Manhart heads for Dextra Kotskaiva's Hopi-style jar with its gracefully rounded shape and feathered design.
I don't think that the majority of people, even today, still look at Native American artifacts and as works of art. However, this particular vessel form, seed pot form, is extraordinary and has certainly gone beyond the tradition, the Native American tradition, as far as decoration and form. Certainly in Japanese culture or Chinese culture, these works are considered works of art. But we have not crossed that bridge yet.
The traveling version of this show includes some 200 post-World War II pieces by nearly 150 artists. Each piece was carefully chosen in a process that took the Manharts nearly 7 years. They looked for work that would strike down traditional definitions of craft and art. A large portion of the show focuses on function as well as form. While some definitions of art exclude objects that were designed for a function, Tom Manhart insists that can actually enhance artistic value. He points to Wharton Escherich's Library Steps with Elephant and Donkey Finials, a glorified ladder carved from hickory.
It's curious to me that an object that I consider to be as beautiful as this one cannot be looked at in some circles as a piece of sculpture in the same way it's looked at as a library step. Same with a very recent work of Sam Maloof's across the room called Settee. I tend to look at these pieces personally and approach them as sculpture first because they're so convincing in the way they use line and form, positive, negative space, things of that nature. I tend to approach them the same way that I approach a piece of sculpture. And gee, isn't it wonderful when you find out you can sit on it or you can get your books off the library shelf with it.
The Manharts say they can't quite figure out why there's such a fuss over the definitions of art and craft, why the art world works so hard to distinguish between the two. They scoff at strict art historians who insist on putting chronology over context. As the eloquent object travels from Chicago to Orlando, Richmond, and Japan in the coming year, the Manharts hope the emotions generated by a work will become more important than its definition. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Visitors to Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History will become archaeologists when they visit the $2.2 million Inside Ancient Egypt exhibit set to open next month. This exhibit, designed through extensive research, is the only place outside of Egypt to explore a life-size tomb complex. As Marge Halpern reports, it's a dramatic modern way to bring ancient history alive.
There'll be a big door here. See it sitting up in the courtyard? A Jigundo door. And it will open, you know, across this way, and you'll be able to enter the tomb.
That's the sound exhibit developer Janet Kamian wants to hear when the big stone door is in place. Right now, it's a sound made by a most unauthentic plywood door that seals the exhibit from the rest of the museum. On the other side of that door, the splendors of Egypt await in the form of a full-size tomb modeled after that of a 5th dynasty nobleman named Unas Ankh. The Field Museum already had two chambers of that tomb purchased at the turn of the century. They're now being filled out with a combination of well-researched reconstruction and period pieces from the museum collection. In this new arrangement, however, few regular visitors to the field will recognize these pieces, thanks to the innovations of the museum's new director, Michael Spock. He made his mark with the highly interactive Boston Children's Museum and carries that concept to his job in Chicago.
So often, secondary to the objects themselves and all the information locked up in them, because so many museum exhibits are curatorially driven, where the curator is the person who's really sort of answering their own questions or displaying their own enthusiasms in the exhibit. And if you turn the equation around and pay as much attention to the visitor, the user, the client, if you will, you get a very different kind of exhibit. What we get a chance then is to tell a story with these things rather than just display great stuff.
Inside the tomb, the story is one of burial rituals and religious rites. There are reliefs in the bright colors the researchers say were originally used but now rarely seen. There's the offering stone, carved with a hieroglyph known to have been used by Unas Ankh's family.
We've already dedicated it with the pita bread, falafel, myrrh, a bottle of Mamba beer, and we recited the offering formula and said, you know, welcome to the Field Museum. We hope you stay and be our guest.
Janet Kamian says even the construction workers got into the act as they brought in the tomb's 14,000-pound false door to be installed over the offering slab for the spirits to enter and exit.
The riggers, who were terrific, ended up moving it partway on rollers, on wooden rollers. And our Egyptologist here, Frank Urkel, saw them do this and said, that's just the way the ancient Egyptians would have done it. Oh, this is so exciting. And the guy, you know, that sort of the head rigger said, well, yeah, of course, you know. Do you know another way, you know?
Of course, Kamian found the ancient methods wouldn't always work. She's opted for new technology to light and humidify display cases. Tucked out of sight behind the cases, she's arranged a network of PVC pipe with either carefully controlled air or the right lighting sent through each shaft. And since Kamian didn't have an army of pyramid builders to lay heavy limestone blocks, this tomb is made of drywall, sprayed with a concrete mix called gunite, which can be sculpted to look like stone.
We did very elaborate drawings of each and every stone, how each one of them would be distressed. Some of them aren't barely distressed at all, because in fact that's how it happens, because it depends on how the limestone came out of the quarry, some of them went, and which way the wind was blowing for 4,000 years, about, you know, where it would be more distressed. Put a lot of effort into trying to get this to feel right.
We follow the stone wall to a spiral staircase.
And what will happen here pretty soon is that these stones, which are less carefully done than the other stones, will turn into bedrock. See where it starts to be striated? So that you know now you're down inside of the bedrock.
Those spiral stairs take us down a 35-foot shaft to the burial chamber, where we find almost nothing. It seems the tomb robbers have gotten here before us, as they always seem to do. We can, however, find a few pot shards and other tidbits hidden in the corners. Then we follow the robbers' tunnels, which stray a bit from authenticity, to show us display cases full of coffins and clay models of daily life found in tombs from several different periods in Egyptian history. We follow those cases to the end of the tomb and exit into the artificial daylight of a live marsh and canal. Buried in the papyrus, we uncover a 3,847-year-old boat thought to have been used either to transport a pharaoh's body to his burial or left to transport his spirit to the afterlife. The canal leads us to an Egyptian marketplace, which Kamian reconstructed with the help of tomb reliefs found near Unesang's burial site. They're reliefs found on the tombs of relative commoners, barbers.
Mostly, people record, you know, kind of aristocratic kinds of things, and afterlife and gods and goddesses and that sort of thing. Well, these guys show people drinking beer and getting robbed and talking to each other and trading things and... The whole barbering business is there, people getting haircuts, pedicures, manicures, their heads shaved.
All 13 of those scenes are blown up here, filled in with parts of the museum collection. Copper pots fit into a scene on bartering, and ancient implements show how barbering was done. In keeping with the museum's new hands-on emphasis, this part of the exhibit also includes scales to demonstrate the measuring system, equipment for polishing stone and grinding grain, and a huge limestone block on a sledge. Just try to move it. By the time visitors leave this exhibit, Janet Kamian is sure they'll have gained an understanding of ancient Egypt that may have eluded them when this collection was more conventionally displayed. Chances are, visitors will also join Kamian in speculating about the man once buried in these surroundings, Unesank, the king's son who never had a chance to be king.
I just had a flash one day. I thought, I know, he was kind of the nerdy kid. You know, his father was saying things to him like, you know, now and pretty soon you're going to be the king and you have to learn to do this and that and be in the army and all this kind of stuff. And he was saying, but Dad, my stamp collection, you know, that he just maybe didn't, or maybe he died young or tragically in some way. He's depicted as an adult, but he's not depicted with a wife or child or, poor Onus, you know. But on the other hand, we're going to make him live forever here.
For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.